Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
This is a great step in normalizing our relationship. I've always emphasized, and I keep emphasizing, that Rwanda is not enemies or enemy states to Uganda.
Uganda welcomes Rwanda's plan to reopen its border beginning January 31st.
They put a lot of emphasis on education for the first time, and they are going to convene a special summit on education, Transforming Education Summit, later this year. So for us in GPE, Transforming Education is our preoccupation.
The United Nations plans to host a summit this year with the theme of Transforming Education. The board chair of the Global Partnership for Education welcomes the move as a positive step.
So when the president dissolved his cabinet some few days ago, people were happy and were expecting that perhaps maybe the president has listened to their concerns and that he would bring up new faces that would have the technical capability to drive the Ethiopia agenda. But I think most people will be disappointed in terms of the caliber of people that have been appointed.
And Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera reconstitutes his cabinet days after dissolving the old team of ministers. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Uganda State Minister for Foreign Affairs, Okello Oryem, says he looks forward to normalized relations between Kampala and Kigali. This after he welcomed plans by neighboring Rwanda to soon reopen its border starting January 31st. Rwanda closed its border with Uganda in 2019 after accusing Kampala of supporting militant groups to destabilize the country. Uganda, on the other hand, has accused the administration in Rwanda of spying. But relations between the two neighboring countries appear to have improved with a recent trip to Rwanda by President Yoweri Museveni's son, Lieutenant General Muhoozi Kainerugaba, who met with President Paul Kagame. Uganda's State Minister for Foreign Affairs, Okello Oryem, tells me that there are plans for high-level talks between Uganda and Rwanda. He says the meeting will eventually lead the heads of state to hold talks that could significantly improve relations between the two countries.
Well, we welcome this bold step by the government of Rwanda, and particularly the President Kagame, for accepting to open the border with Uganda by the end of this month. This is a great step in normalizing our relationship. I've always emphasized, and I keep emphasizing, that Rwanda is not enemies or enemy states to Uganda. Uganda and Rwanda are friends and brothers in all sense and manner. What has happened recently in our relationship was a small disagreement. I call it a small disagreement between us, which we have finally overcome. As friends, occasionally we disagree, but what is important is our capacity to make sure we overcome those disagreements and continue being friends. And this is what has happened here. So we look forward now to strengthening our relationship and resuming our historical relationship towards the integration of the East African community.
Now, Mr. Oryem, what steps is Kampala wishing to make moving forward to bolster the relationship between Kampala and Kigali?
What is important is that between now and the 1st of February or the 31st of January is for us to get things normalized. Customs and people have to go on the ground. Of course, the health people have to be on the ground. The security people have to be on the ground so the border is physically opened. And the next step, of course, is for the person-to-person contact, which is very vital and very important in this sense. I think there will soon be a meeting, high-level meeting, between the Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Minister of Rwanda as the first step towards the relationship. And then thereafter, soon thereafter, we hope to elevate that contact to pass contact between His Excellency President Museveni of Uganda and President His Excellency President Kagame of Rwanda. Now, once this pass-to-pass contact takes place, I think that will be the icing on the cake, so to say, in our relationship at the moment.
So you think that will ease the reported friction or tension between the two countries after these steps are taken?
I think that the friction that was there has been smoothened. I think the next step now is to polish it. The next step, henceforth, is polishing the normalization of relationship. And by polishing it, I mean the need for us now to start talking directly to each other. First, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, then the two heads of states having the capacity to talk and meet physically.
What impact do you think this will have on the economies of the two countries?
The economies of these two countries are so intertwined. So many Ugandans rely on it. So many Rwandans rely on it. These borders that between the two countries are actually artificial in all sense and manner. And the people who are on the ground physically cross these borders without even knowing where the border is. And we hope now that it's been normalized. There'll be no arresting of people whenever they cross the borders of both sides.
What do you think should be the major takeaways of this gesture that the Ugandan government is welcoming?
I think there's need for us to appreciate, understand each other better. What is important now is that for us to ensure and learn lessons that whatever caused the friction never reoccurs again. Whatever caused the friction, we should avoid at each stage of our relationship to make sure that those incidents does not take place. We have to make sure that our priority now is strengthening our relationship. Our strengthening now is working towards the East African integration, economic integration, social integration, and hopefully in future, political integration.
Okello Oryem is Uganda State Minister for Foreign Affairs. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The United Nations plans to host a summit this year with the theme of transforming education. The conference aims to provide an opportunity to address what officials say are the systematic issues that prevent children from learning. The meeting comes as the coronavirus pandemic continues to disrupt education globally. This, experts say, significantly impacts learning among girls and vulnerable children. They add that the Omicron variant is worsening the pandemic's impact on education systems around the world. One group that's fighting to transform learning in the developing world is the Global Partnership for Education, or GPE, which is helping to raise funds to address some of these challenges. The new chair of the GPE, former Tanzania President Jakaya Kikwete, says the organization works to deliver quality education to both girls and boys. He met UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres about the upcoming summit. I reached Mr. Kikwete via Skype and began by asking him about the major takeaways from the meeting and its expectations for the upcoming conference.
The purpose of the visit for me really is to introduce myself. But of course, the most important thing which brought us here is that, you know, the Secretary General has announced our common agenda. They put a lot of emphasis on education for the first time, and they are going to convene a special summit on education, Transforming Education Summit, later this year. So for us in GPE, transforming education is our preoccupation. So we thought we would come and talk to the Secretary General, the Deputy Secretary General, get the feel of it, but of course offer our readiness to work with the United Nations during the preparatory stage, during the summit itself, and after the summit on the follow-up.
So what were some of the major takeaways of this meeting following this discussion?
We found there was a meeting of minds. The UN also was ready to work with GPE. Yeah, we have agreed on establishing the mechanisms. My vice chair is going to work with the office of the the Deputy Secretary General in the preparation. We also have officials from the Secretariat of GPE who are also going to be part of that. So we are going to initiate discussions now on the modalities of cooperation. What are the roles that the UN wants GPE to perform in that regard? But we support, we expressed our deepest appreciation to the Secretary General for thinking about it. Also for support the holding of the summit, and praying that the summit comes out a successful one. Because we need political will at the highest levels possible. And when we have a summit that is organized by the United Nations, or heads of state and government from member states participating and discussing the education agenda, I'm sure some of the challenges that we are facing now may have answers and solutions.
So, Mr. President, talk to me about the state of education in developing countries, especially during this pandemic period.
There is an education crisis, and a serious one. But the problem is more pronounced in the developing countries. Today in the world, 250 million children are out of school. Unfortunately, 100 million of these are in Africa. Even those children who are in school, many are not completing their education. In fact, they estimated that time for primary school is at 33%, which is, these are huge numbers. And then the third thing is that even those who complete their education, they're not learning enough. The learning outcomes are low. So those are the three major characters. But then of course, here comes COVID. COVID makes the bad situation worse. School closure has kept 1.6 billion students out of school. We already have a problem with 250 million. Now you add 1.6 billion. The crisis has worsened. And then of course, when they are out of school, they are not learning. If they are not learning, then there's a problem. The other thing which has manifested itself, now the inequality in the world. In the developed world, here in America, in Europe, schools were closed, but students continue to learn. They learned online. Internet is there. The laptops are there. Smartphones are available. But in the developing world, in our part of the world, the schools were closed. They are completely closed. It made a difficult situation worse.
Well, Mr. President, I understand the pandemic, as you rightly put it, is severely disrupting education system around the world, particularly in low-income countries that the Global Partnership for Education, your organization, supports. How else is your organization helping address this major problem?
We're providing financing. But of course, we have been working on quality education. And first, of course, the programs are country-owned. It is the country itself that decides on what they want to do. They will sit down, discuss with various players, get a lot of advice from our team, because GPE does not have offices in the countries. No. GPEs work through the various agencies. There are countries where we work with the UNICEF as the agent. Some we work with the World Bank, some with the UNESCO. So we work with a number of other organizations. But for us, we channel funds through these organizations, and we call these grant agents. These are the grant agents. It is those particular agents that are actually working with the governments. Our people are also working with the governments. After we have agreed on the program, and then in terms of financing, we channel funds through the grant agents. So countries decide on what kind of a program or programs they need, which they believe if this program is implemented, it's going to have a ripple effect in transforming the education system. And then, of course, for us, when there's agreement, we provide finance. Of course, we raise money through donors.
Former Tanzania President Jakaya Kikwete is the board chair of the Global Partnership for Education, or GPE. He spoke with me from New York. Kenya's incumbent deputy president, William Ruto, is promising to defeat his main rival, former Prime Minister Raila Odinga, in the upcoming August presidential election. This after announcing an alliance he calls the Hustler Movement to win the upcoming polls. The move, the deputy president says, aims to unite Kenyans as part of the effort to eradicate tribal politics in the run-up to the elections. His remarks come after a former Vice President Musalia Mudavadi and former Foreign Minister Moses Wetangula joined his party in an alliance before the vote. Kenyans are scheduled to vote for a new president, members of the National Assembly and the Senate on August 9. Analysts say they expect a competitive presidential contest between the incumbent deputy president and the former prime minister. For the latest development, I reach Okiya Omtata, an activist and political commentator in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
As long as Kenyan politicians mobilize support along ethnic lines, and it remains the most or the easiest way of mobilizing support, then you can see that the alliance building, or so-called alliance building or tribal formations that are coming up, are basically designed to maximize the tribal votes in each region. And so the deputy president, I think, seems to have an understanding that people join this alliance as tribal entities, which is largely true to an extent that tribalism is a major tool of mobilization in the Kenyan polity. So the alliances we have made symbolically are good and encouraging, but I don't know that the alliances of leaders also involve the alliances of the people, because some of us have listened to the crowd saying that the leaders may be moving alone and the people may be moving in different directions. But the situation is still very fluid at the moment, so it's a question of waiting to see what happens. I checked on either him or on the former Prime Minister, Honorable Raila Odinga. So by dismantling it, it means that then him and the Honorable Raila Odinga have to scramble for whatever dividends have come out of that.
But the Deputy President said main opposition leader Raila Odinga, former Prime Minister Raila Odinga, did not stand a chance against what he described as the Hustler Movement, saying Kenyans have lost faith in him. What is your take on that?
Well, there's an element that Raila does not no longer represent the progressive forces in Kenya, and that is largely due to the fact that his association with His Excellency Uhuru Kenyatta, the President of Kenya, has planted his image as the bearer of opposition politics, and therefore it's really a matter of time before that is taken out. But you see, Raila is also facing somebody who is not really a good, who has got a lot of baggage. And so the choice is between two evils, and the people basically may default to the lesser evil of the two evils. So Raila having diminished in stature and being surrounded by old people who may not have traction with the youth who are surrounding the deputy president, may not necessarily be written off, given that the deputy president himself has come with a lot of baggage that is revulsive to many people, especially in terms of abuse of public resources and allegations of corruption and stuff like that. So he has a lot to fight.
What is the percentage of the poll so far?
There's more than a 5-point difference between the two, which is happening. But in Kenya, the country runs on 50 plus one. So now both of them are fairly far from the 50 plus one mark, although the vice president is much closer.
Do you think an endorsement from outgoing President Uhuru Kenyatta would have any significant impact?
It will have some impact, but let us remember that when Uhuru Kenyatta himself was endorsed by former President Daniel Arap Moi, he lost the election. And so the endorsement comes with its own baggage, because he inherits the baggage of outgoing regime. But on the other hand, it gives you the access to state resources, which are very, very important in a country whereby people expect politicians to dig deep in their pockets to finance their campaigns and to give handouts to their voters. So access to state like this may be a big boon to whoever gets that endorsement. And I think it has done Raila a lot of good, because it has given him profile, it has given him ability to run around. But as I said, he has also planted his image as the doyen of opposition politics and progressive thinking, and a leader to an alternative Kenya. He has lost that mantle to I don't know who, and we do, but I think William Ruto is struggling to take up that mantle and present himself as the messianic figure, so to speak.
Okiya Omtata is a Kenyan activist and political commentator. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi. In Zambia, the leader of the opposition Heritage Party is calling on President Hakainde Hichilema's government to launch an independent investigation into the shortages of medicines in hospitals across the southern African country. Madam Chishala Kateka also says the probe should look into the policies of the country's pharmacies. Her remarks come after some activists expressed concern that patients are directed to specific drug stores linked to employees of the state-run hospitals to fill their prescriptions. They are calling for an inquiry to determine if the shortages have been created by pharmacies to push prices up. But some industry experts say problems with the global supply chain caused by the coronavirus pandemic is to blame for the shortages in Zambia and elsewhere around the world. To learn more about her call for an inquiry into the shortage of medicines in Zambia, I reach opposition figure Madam Chishala Kateka in the capital, Lusaka.
So what happens when an individual goes into a hospital, the doctor will diagnose something and they will write a prescription. So rather than saying, go to the dispensary to get this medicine, people will actually point you to a certain chemist. Some time back, it was found that a number of these chemists are owned by hospital personnel. So the concern is that these personnel may, I'm not saying that they do, but they may, because they are connected to hospitals, so they may be siphoning some of the medicines. I'm not saying that they do, and that's why I'm saying there should be an investigation.
So basically, you are saying there appears to be an artificial shortage, so it will force patients to go to specific chemists or pharmacists to purchase medication?
Two things could be at play here. Number one could be that genuinely we do have shortages, and then the medical personnel are taking advantage of those shortages in order to take advantage of those shortages. Or it could be in some cases that some medical personnel actually do get medicines from the hospitals and take them to their chemists. So what I am calling the government to do is to determine what the actual situation is.
Well, Madam Kateka, some people are suggesting that this has been going on for some time now, and Zambians have really gotten used to it, and it's working efficiently.
One of the things that I keep saying to Zambians is we must not settle for the lowest common denominator. We've begun to accept what we should not be accepting. And that is our downfall as a people. We must not accept what we should not be accepting. You know, when government tells you, oh, free medical services, what does that mean? Does that mean that you just go for consultation and you call that free medical services? There are so many poor people out there because they cannot afford to go into the chemist. We'll get Panadol for malaria, Panadol for whatever disease that they have, Panadol for cancer. It can't work. So we must begin to do things the way we are supposed to do them.
Well, some people are suggesting that there's a global supply chain problem and every country is feeling the pinch. Even the wealthy countries in the West are feeling the pinch. So it should not be uncommon that people are feeling the same in Zambia. How do you address that?
So there are levels. Okay, there are levels of a nation's ability to meet something or not to meet something. If some medicine is coming into the country ordered by the government and then somebody is misappropriating them, we should not accept that aspect of depriving the Zambian people. That's the point we are making.
How do you think the government can address this perennial shortage of medicines that are not in public hospitals but are in private pharmacies? What do you think is the best way forward?
That's why we, as our party, is asking for the government to actually investigate this. I mean, we as a nation, we bleed in so many ways. The medicines, we bleed in other ways, and that's why the government, you know, really needs to look at these issues, because when they do, and this is happening in the electricity sector, in the fuel sector, we are always bleeding as nations. And if we could get the right institutions and the right systems in place, it will go a long way towards securing whatever it is that we do get for our nations.
Madam Chishala Katenka is the leader of the opposition Heritage Party. She spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera is reconstituting his cabinet days after dissolving the old team of ministers. The president came under pressure from civil society, religious and opposition groups, who say some in his cabinet were not effective, while others have been accused of graft. Announcing a second batch of members to his cabinet, the president removed three additional high-profile advisers. Among them is former Foreign Minister Eisenhower Mkaka, an influential member of the ruling party who has been moved to the Ministry of Natural Resources. But critics say the president appears to have retained a significant number of the old cabinet ministers. They expressed concern that he might not be able to keep his promises, including weeding out corruption and boosting service delivery and standards of living, if he maintains most of his old team. For the latest development, I reach Ernest Lamek Thindwa, a leading member of the Political Science Association of Malawi.
What Malawians were expecting, that they'll be presented with a cabinet that would be acceptable to them, because the initial cabinet, right from the beginning, people had reservations in terms of how it was constituted. One, people had problems with the original representation. People felt that there was too much consideration of people who share the same tribe and religion with the president. So they felt it was a generalistic kind of cabinet, and this time around they were expecting a better cabinet formation. Beyond the regional, they also talked about the capability of the people who were appointed. Most people were of the view that the initial cabinet really did not have the kind of people that would deliver the agenda that was promised by the Tulsi Alliance during each campaign period. So when the president dissolved his cabinet some few days ago, people were happy and were expecting that perhaps maybe the president has listened to their concerns and that he would bring up new faces that would have the technical capability to drive the Tulsi agenda. But I think most people will be disappointed in terms of the caliber of people that have been appointed.
Why wouldn't you give people the chance to prove their worth? Some people are telling me that the president is a listening president. He dissolved the cabinet, got rid of some people, and named new faces.
As I say, about 80% of the cabinet has been returned. So yes, there have been new faces that have been brought in, and some old faces are dropped. And that's where people concerns are, because the general view is that the first cabinet did not live to expectations, and therefore they needed a cabinet that they would believe in, that they would have trust in to drive the Tulsi Alliance agenda. Unfortunately, the majority have been attained, and that is really raising skepticism among citizens.
Where do you think the president can go from here after this new cabinet that you said people seem not to be pleased with?
The important thing now is to impress upon the cabinet ministers that have been appointed to make sure that they deliver. They should deliver to Malawians observable results. Then the people will feel that they have been compensated in one way or the other. The challenge, you know, Malawi is facing is that when people were voting in 2019 and 2020, the idea was to make sure that there is some significant change in their daily life. And this significant change was to come about through improvement in terms of service delivery. There has not been significant change in terms of service delivery, apart from changing government. Service delivery remains more or less the same, and people are questioning what was the point of changing government when service delivery remained the same. Meaning, the cabinet has not lived up to expectations. Service delivery still remains very low and very poor in a number of aspects, and that's an issue. The reason people would be skeptical to say this is the cabinet that has not delivered to expectations, and 90%, okay, 80% has been retained. So they may not have faith in terms of improvement, in terms of service delivery, in a cabinet that has largely been retained. Have there been significant changes in terms of personnel in the cabinet? Maybe people would give the president the benefit of doubt. But if you ask most Malawians, there is skepticism in terms of whether the cabinet can deliver.
Some people say that perhaps the Tonse Alliance overpromised, and that is what is causing a major letdown by some critics of the government. What is your assessment?
If you ask the leadership of Tonse Alliance, they have not conceded to say they overpromised, and they still believe they will deliver. While some other quarters really are alleging that perhaps maybe there was overpromise to citizens. But the question is whether they overpromised or not. At the end of the day, what people want to see is some change in terms of public service delivery. That is the key issue. And Malawians are not as demanding. They simply want their basic needs to be met. Malawians are not looking for affluent life. They know that affluence has to be achieved through individual effort and the like. But for the basics, they still believe it is the government responsibility to make sure that the basics are met. And those are the things that are not being met. You have so many people not still connected with water, not connected with electricity. Roads are not in good shape. Education, health services are still below what you call international standards. And those are the issues Malawians are concerned about. So whether it was an overpromise or not, the question is there has been not any notable significant change in terms of quality of service and the service delivery in general.
Ernest Lamek Findwa is a leading member of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Blantyre. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Botswana, civil society groups, journalists, and the Southern African Media Institute for Southern Africa, or MISA, are expressing concern over a new measure being considered by Parliament that they say will undermine freedom of speech. This after the government proposed a law that enables the security agencies to monitor cell phones without a court-sanctioned warrant. The measure, called the Controlled Investigation Bill, also grants immunity to security operatives while carrying out their jobs and allows them to use fake IDs and passports when working. Supporters say the security agencies need the protection the new measure provides, which they contend will empower operatives to carry out their jobs without any challenges. But opponents say the new measure will undermine the country's democracy. For more on the reasons behind the opposition to the new measure, I reach Tefo Patwani, National Director of the Media Institute for Southern Africa, or MISA, in Botswana.
Number one, we think it is unconstitutional. Number two, it borders on criminality. And it erodes freedom of expression. It erodes our liberties as citizens. That's one of the problems that we have. It also affects journalism negatively, because then if you are going to allow people to tap our phones without a court order, that means we don't know what they're listening to. We don't know who's listening. Remember, the Act also allows for the investigation agencies or security agencies to use fake IDs and passports, but they're legalizing it, so there won't be fake IDs per se. That means maybe this person will have two or three different IDs with different names issued by the Department of Immigration.
Does that mean that MISA civil society groups will consider legal action since you describe this as an illegal move or unconstitutional move by the government?
Yes, we're still engaging. It is at an initial stage. Like I said, it was read in Parliament yesterday, and the ruling party voted for its agency. That means it will be read again in Parliament very soon, and ultimately the debate on the proposed bill will begin. While this process is going on, we're engaging with other civil societies, including Botswana Law Society, to advise what could we do going forward legally, maybe approach the courts of law to try to stop this.
But some people are suggesting that the government is mandated by the Constitution to protect life and property. And if this is necessary to ensure that bad people do not, you know, organize to destabilize the country, it is in good taste, and the Constitution backs the government to do so. What do you make of that? How do you respond to that?
Yes, we agree to that. But there's already a process that has been used since day one. So if you are a suspect, for instance, the investigating agencies or security agencies will then seek a warrant from the court. Say, we suspect this person because of 1, 2, 3, maybe he's a drug dealer or he's a terrorist. We seek permission to check into their personal information. It has happened for so many years. It is a normal practice that should obtain under the Democratic Republic. Not where they do it without anybody's knowledge. They do it without the court's knowledge or your knowledge as the owner of that information. And we don't even know what the reasons are behind that. You understand? So this law will be prone to abuse, especially political opponents.
Why do you think it will be prone to abuse? Because Botswana doesn't have a history, as some people argue, of abusing the rights of its citizens.
No, those people don't know anything. They don't live here. We know what is happening politically here. The Directorate of Intelligence and Security Services was formed basically in 2008 when the new President Khama came on board. And how it happened, it brought fear on people. Like, we never had a security agent roaming around with guns or catching people on the streets and with guns, everybody, like, you know, that was scary to Botswana, was a new scene to Botswana. And it has happened against political opponents of the ruling party. Towards 2019 elections, the state organs were used to harass the political leaders from the opposition, especially the president of the opposition, Advocate Dumaboko. He was harassed in parliament, taken out, and the Botswana Unified Revenue Services said he owes tax, and they took his car in parliament. But then the question is, how many people from the ruling party owe tax and are not busted like he was? There is imbalance in terms of or selective justice, I'll say that, in terms of how things run here. If you're in the opposition, you have to be careful of what you do. Your books have to be in order. Your conduct has to be in order. But the ruling party people do as they please.
Tefo Patwane is the National Director of the Media Institute for Southern Africa, or MISA, in Botswana. He spoke with me from the capital, Gaborone. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a pro-democracy youth group is calling for an end to human rights abuses in the country. Lucha, which advocates for non-violent community-level change and government reform, says troops from the National Army and the police are increasingly committing human rights violations. The group is calling on the government to ensure an independent investigation and the prosecution of police officers or soldiers responsible for the crimes. Fred Bauma is a leading member of Lucha.
He tells me that political leaders and others who engage or encourage human rights violations must be prosecuted under the full force of the law, irrespective of their societal status.
President Tshisekedi declared the region between North Kivu and Ituri provinces to be under state of siege. And in practical, this was supposed to mean political authority will be transferred to military, so military will take over, and they were supposed to launch military operation against those armed groups, and it was supposed to lead to some solution in terms of reduction of killing. But at the end, the security situation in the East didn't really improve with it. What we see is the increase in terms of human rights violation in that region, repression of peaceful activists. A colleague of ours was just killed a few days ago in Beni while trying to demonstrate. People who later tried to organize a mourning for him were repressed by the police. This state of siege is becoming more and more a way to repress peaceful demonstration or any ideas that doesn't fit, go along with what the government wants us to say.
But Fred, the government recently announced a joint military operation with the Uganda Armed Forces against the ADF rebels you talked about. How successful is this at the moment? Because there have been successes reported where the ADF rebels or militants have been running away and are being defeated.
Well, I can say how successful it was. It's very difficult to say it right now, and maybe in the future we'll be able to see some progress. One thing that is worth mentioning is that we had many military operations since 2014. And every time there is an operation in that region, there is reports that ADF stronghold were recuperated by the governmental forces, or in this case with the UPDF. But we don't really know how it will look like in the near future. What we know is that ADF is very good in adapting itself in this kind of operation. So, but that is one thing. The second thing is there is not a lot of transparency around these operations.
Are you therefore saying that the government's effort to try to protect unarmed civilians is being undermined by alleged human rights violations that the organization is talking about?
The government is alleging that it's trying to put, reinforcing the power of the military in order to protect the people. But what we are seeing in reality is that in cities like Goma, there is an increase in terms of insecurity and killings, actually, day in and daylight sometimes. In Beni and Butembo, what we see is the continuous repression of demonstrators and peaceful protesters. And that so far has, my movement has paid a high price on those demonstrations. During this period, we had one colleague of ours who had his leg amputated because of police repression, and another young guy who just finished his high school was killed by the police just 3 days ago. So what I'm saying is, yes, it's good for the government to say we are trying to protect you, we are putting this measure in order to protect you, but the reality is more and more the impression that the state doesn't exist in that region where the military have a lot of power.
So your group would want a full investigation, an independent investigation into these allegations, and those responsible held accountable for their actions.
Right, exactly. And in this particular, in the case of our colleague who was killed in Beni a few days ago, we would like to see the mayor of Beni removed temporarily, the time for investigation. And if it's not guilty, I mean, he can come back. But there is a lot of allegation, including the videos of himself, taking responsibility of what will happen and what happened. So what we are calling for is to see the mayor of Beni and other military involved in this repression in Beni or in Goma be held to account.
Fred Bauma is a leading member of Lucha, a group which advocates for nonviolent community-level change and government reform. He spoke with me from New York. A new assessment by the World Food Programme finds a record 9 million people across three conflict-affected regions in northern Ethiopia are suffering from acute hunger. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
A United Nations survey conducted in Tigray before the conflict erupted in November 2020 found 93% of the population had enough to eat. Now, some 15 months into the war, the UN reports 83% of the population is short of food, with nearly 40% gripped by severe hunger. The World Food Programme reports 13% of Tigrayan children under age 5 and half of all pregnant and breastfeeding women are malnourished. WFP spokesman Thompson Fieri says lack of proper nourishment is leading to low birth weight, stunting, and maternal deaths. He says people who cannot feed themselves are resorting to extreme coping measures to survive.
Diets are increasingly impoverished as food items become unavailable and families rely almost exclusively on cereals while limiting portion sizes and the number of meals they eat each day to make whatever food is available stretch further.
As the war in Tigray has spread across northern Ethiopia, hunger also has spread widely to neighboring Amhara and Afar regions. Fieri says fighting and conflict-driven displacement is pushing hunger and malnutrition rates up to dangerous levels in those regions.
Now, WFP estimates that on average, crisis-affected families in northern Ethiopia were getting less than 30% of their caloric needs in the past months, pushing people deeper into crisis. It's expected that that constant humanitarian food assistance will be required at least throughout 2022.
Despite the many challenges, the WFP reports it has managed to deliver food aid to nearly 4 million people across northern Ethiopia since March. However, it says intense fighting in the region has prevented food convoys from reaching Tigray since mid-December. The WFP is appealing to the warring parties to agree to a humanitarian pause so agencies can safely transport life-saving food, medicine, and other essential relief through the front lines. It says the lives, the health, and well-being of millions of civilians depend on it. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Zoli ganyambala na bikuku cho kubolo ve wange munju kirakura kamuntamu ebange tenericho. Just like a chuma royangina ni uma kacho sanyu kanze numwa chichiche nakola nisame. Abalala teba manye cheba kola mochi pechi no kwa singa. Oh, give me the chance. Oh, give me the chance. Nakukola chichichi wachuka mpano kwa mbira koncha. Nakuita tuongere wagana tabu ya muli mumuli. Why, baby, why do you make me cry? Chichi, echa kunyiza, nakola chicho tantekeza.
I'm for your love.
Natomoli misonanga ina dikolo na monite, lokola yo. Natomoli misonanga ina dikolo na monite, lokola yo. Sintina olaba, kolinga kasana kumi. Nakupikiria sana nataka kuwa nawe, just do it for me. Manyachi no wubula utukayo nangepata mango mukubye kuwa tuyagale paka paka. Napenda tupena niopendi tupena ni kwani kito zangu zote ni moja kuishi na we nyumbani. Natumayo kaweza luli kata mukuburi weyanga mbati notulio.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor William Eagle and producer Douglas Impuga, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the frog does not jump in the daytime without reason. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington.